You were concluding about the loan policies, how they were looked at from various functional areas of the company. Can you talk to whether the chief risk officer would review the LPG changes at all as part of the review?
The credit department, the credit risk management department,
right,
which is under the chief risk officer, would have to sign off.
Gotcha.
You know, in terms of, you know, the nuts and bolts and loan program guides and who, how, when, I'm not familiar with that.
So we wouldn't know if Mr. McMurray or his equivalent before he came on board or while he was on board, whether or not his department or him personally would review those LPG changes?
I mean, at the point that we had a chief, you know, at the point that we had a chief risk officer and a credit department, a credit risk management department, that area would need to sign off. The process and the people within that area, I can't speak to that.
Okay. Thanks.
So we were talking about how the guidelines expanded in 2003, and you were explaining to us how Countrywide went about making changes to products that it would offer on its menu. Any opinions on why guidelines were expanding in the 2003 and forward time period? You've mentioned a little, but the supply
and demand stuff. Well, I can create a lot of opinions mm-hmm. about that. You know, there was a desire on the part of investors to invest in assets that had a higher degree of risk and that for which they could be, you know, get a higher levels of compensation. When that was a big driver, there was a desire amongst, you know, many consumers for products, you know, for the desire, you know, consumers who desired to purchase a home and enjoy the benefits of home ownership. There was a desire for products that would allow for lesser down payments or would allow for payments that might be lower in the early years but would increase in later years as their expected income increased. There was a desire for products where, you know, certain consumers, you know, might have difficulty documenting their income. And so there was a desire for on the part of consumers to purchase homes and that they felt that they could afford and wanted, you know, that loan programs might not have allowed before. And there was a desire on the part of investors to extend that credit and price that credit. And then there was this belief, and I know it was my belief, that the paradigm had changed in the U.S. mortgage market, where because of the sophistication of the global capital markets, because people had modeling proficiencies that seemed to be very sophisticated, that risk was priceable. And in many cases, making loans with these expanded guidelines, were certainly the expansion of the attributes, you know, certainly made them more riskier. Default rates were expected to be higher. That increased risk was something that could be modeled and that could be priced for and appropriately and so that the loans could be made and in fact, you know, it was the perception of, you know, many people, certainly myself, that this was a new paradigm that would, you know, exist forever, you know, and that's the evolution and sophistication of the market, you know, allowed for this kind of expansion of guidelines. And then, as I said, there was, you know, other factors, exogenous factors, or, you know, it was very much, it seemed to be a public policy initiative to enable an increase in home ownership rate, to particularly enable an increase in, you know, in these segments of the market that had historically been underserved. And so you had a convergence of variables, you know, the ability to price risk, the demand for these loans amongst investors, the demand for housing amongst consumers for these loans who felt that they could, you know, afford the homes, the public policy piece of it, and all together converge to explain why guidelines expanded in the market. And then with respect to what explained them expanding in Countrywide was, as I said, our business model was such that we were just an intermediary. We were a supermarket offering that which was otherwise offered and which we believed were legitimate, you know, desirable products to offer to consumers, you know, in spite of the fact that, there certainly was, an expectation that default rates, you know, would increase on certain products that had, you know, more risky attributes, and that was all priced in. But in almost all cases, you know, the belief, you know, was that that default rates would be acceptable, and that the winners, those that didn't default, and those that would get to enjoy the benefit of home ownership, you know, would exponentially outweigh and dwarf, you know, the those that did default. And so it seemed as if, you know, it seemed as if it made sense during the time. It seemed as if, you know, there was really very, you know, there was very, very little of, you know, dissension of voices in the marketplace, and nobody really, during the time, at least as I looked at things, you know, was very concerned or alarmed, you know. It might have been, you know, debates about individual little programs, from time to time. But that was kind of like that was the condition. I would say that, as you know, it was concern or alarm because there was some sort of issues that surfaced that were debated, as I'm sure you know. But I would say those are the conditions that explain why guidelines were expanded.
Okay. Did Countrywide have models that it would use to try to predict the default rates on the new products that didn't have histories?
We did. We tried to build models. Countrywide probably was a latecomer in developing credit projection models because, as I said, up until the point that we started our bank, we had a chief investment officer or a chief risk officer or a chief credit officer because we just had a secondary marketing department, which is the case with most mortgage bankers. They only have a secondary marketing department. And we only introduced these, you know, departments once we got the bank and we got, we started to invest in assets on our balance sheet that had some credit risk, you know, to the extent primarily the bank and maybe to a lesser extent some residual securities that we kept from our securitizations. And coinciding with that, we started building models. And so yes, we had models. We were developing models. We were constantly modifying models. But for the most part, we relied on the models in existence in the secondary market, the models used by investors in Wall Street, that in the rating agencies, and those are the models that, you know, that were used to price, if you will, you know, these mortgage loans and securities with the expanded guidelines.
Now, in 2003, I believe, was the year for the most originations and a lot of refis, and then going forward with rates being higher, sort of the refi market declined substantially. Did you see that, the decline of the refi market, having any impact on the loosening of the guidelines, or the expansion of the guidelines, I think is how you termed it?
Perhaps that could have been a factor. And to the extent that volume otherwise dropped in the industry, perhaps people might have been motivated to look for opportunities to, you know, to offset the impact of the drop.
Well, are you just speculating now about what others might have been thinking in the marketplace?
Yeah. As I said, it doesn't explain our motivation. Our motivation is explained by what I described. You know, we were a follower.
Okay, so I took that speculation from the word perhaps. Okay. But in terms of Countrywide in particular, was there any recognition or effort in the 2004 timeframe forward saying, look, refi volume is down, we need to do more on purchase money mortgages?
I would say that, you know, Countrywide was always motivated to grow grow volume, to grow market share, and by extension to grow earnings. And as you can imagine, you know, we're a public company, we're large, with a large market cap, and and you know, it was incumbent on us to add shareholder value and to grow, have earnings growth, and so we're always looking at to make sure that we covered all bases and that we were offering all those products which we were able to offer, that consumers had demand that we could sell, and you know, those were the variables.
So earlier you had mentioned, let me find it in my notes, that you know, the company would make loans if they were sellable to the secondary market, subject to some filters. And you know, I just have to find my notes on your filters. Ah, and the filters, actually, what you said was, you know, Countrywide would add loans to its menu, being a supermarket lender. But there were also filters. They had to be sellable to the secondary market. They had to be appropriate for consumers. They'd be paid back. They couldn't, you didn't do the loans that were considered high interest rate loans under HOPA. And then there was a catch-all filter. It wouldn't adversely impact Countrywide's reputation. Explain to me how Countrywide went about, you know, practically, you know, working those filters to determine what expanded guideline loans it would offer and which ones it would not.
I mean, the reputational filter was a kind of a qualitative or subjective thing that we would discuss, with respect to certain products. But also, we sought to quantify it with respect to the interest rate, the cost on those loans, and the expected default rates. And so, if we saw a loan through expected default rates that we thought, were very high, that would, we knew that that was not in our interest, and that would be, even if we could sell the risk, and that could impact our reputation. And so it was addressed kind of generally in that way with respect to the expected default rates, with respect to the HOPA thing had a linkage in there. And so those are some ways in which we touched on reputation. To the extent that there was some concern about a particular product, sometimes it would be elevated to a committee, one of our governance committees. We called it a responsible lending committee, and we would debate the product and the pros and cons of whether we should offer it or not, or what people were saying about it, and those were all ways in which we kind of touched on this reputational issue.
Okay. So when you were, one of the things you just mentioned was if the expected default rates were too high, then you wouldn't want to make those loans because it would hurt Countrywide's reputation. How did Countrywide estimate the expected default rates? Was that through the modeling that you were just talking about?
Either through that or through our own modeling or through other people's modeling.
Who was on the responsible lending committee?
It was, I'm not sure who all the members were. I was on it. Stan Curlin was on it. Sandy Samuels, chief legal officer, was on it.
And Mr. Samuels is the chief legal officer? Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yes.
Was Mr. Mazzillo on it?
I am not sure.
Was the chief risk officer on it?
I believe he was on it.
Chief credit officer?
Yeah, the chief risk officer and the chief credit officer were one and the same, I think, for a period, John McMurray.
Okay.
Chris, I believe we get any documents on this. So
okay.
That would be back to you.
I understand. You know that I still have to get people's opinions on stuff. Okay, so let me ask you, one of the things we've seen in terms of the loans being retained by the company is, again, we've seen an increase in retention of, for example, the payment option ARM book. You had talked a little bit before how the company was growing and was retaining certain loans. And we saw, for example, from the company's public filings and from other filings, for example, the payment option ARM book went from $4.7 billion in 2004 up to $26 billion in 2005, $32.8 billion in 2006, and then not surprisingly down a little to $28.9 billion in 2007. And two, during that 4-year period, the those loan balances as a percentage of equity went from 46% in 04 to 204% in 05, 230% in 06, still 200% when it's down a little in 07. And my question with that lead-in is, did Countrywide look at its retention of payment option arm and other type loan classes as a percentage of capital? Were there limits in that regard at all?
I'm not sure what all the investment criteria the bank was. I only kind of got involved in that at the latter part of 06, really, you know, as I said. But the way in which our bank looked at assets was certainly with respect to capital. There was, you know, core capital. There were requirements, you know, certainly, you know, regulatory capital for certain asset classes, whether it be second mortgages or first mortgages, and then there was also something we called economic capital that we looked at, you know, which took into consideration the different risk. And I think the company, you know, looked at the landscape of investor, you know, whole loan investment opportunities and all of the attributes, the relevant attributes of those investment opportunities, the credit risk, the interest rate risk, the return, the pricing and compensation for that risk, you know, they did modeling and they determined what to invest in based on that. And they determined that the pay option loans was a very good asset for the bank to invest in, as they determined that home equity loans were, and that's what explains the growth and the bank's decision to invest in those assets.
And understanding that, though, do you recall whether or not the company would look at risk in terms of concentrations of capital?
I think the ratio of capital to the assets was a consideration. I'm not sure the specifics, you know, in terms of what metrics they looked at for different subsets of the assets.
Do you recall, you know, again in this 2004 to 2007 time frame, you know, whether there was there a contrarian view being voiced within the company saying we shouldn't be accumulating this kind of risk on the balance sheet?
I would say that we began re-examining the bank's investor strategy and the portfolio strategy, around mid 2006, as we saw interest rates going up and housing, you know, conditions change. You know, the, you know, levels of appreciations were lessening. You know, so the environment was changing. There was a lot of focus in the industry and by the regulators on the non-traditional products, and so I would say around that time, you know, we kind of began re-examining the bank strategy and whether we should continue to grow the bank and we should continue to grow these different asset categories like pay options and home equity loans, or whether we should slow down the growth of the bank, whether we should sell assets, insure them, and different people had different views, and I would say that really kind of, my recollection is it kind of started in the, you know, in the mid 06 time period.
Okay, prior to mid-06, I mean, do you recall whether there was, the numbers I read to you show, you know, a substantial increase from 04 to 05, a six-fold increase from $4.5 billion to $26 billion. Any recollection of whether there was a contrarian position before the mid-2006 time frame?
Not that I'm aware of. But, you know, as I said, I wasn't involved in the investment decisions of Countrywide Bank, but not that surfaced to my attention.